when a family he was working with brought a so-called psychic on board to help locate a missing teenager. She advised the investigators to concentrate the search in an industrial area east of the city, despite the fact that the girl had last been seen near the Amtrak station and was widely believed, within the police force anyway, to be a runaway. Lucinda claimed that the girl had been boldly abducted from a city street by two men in a black pickup truck, raped, and kept alive for nearly 2 weeks before they decapitated her and buried her head in a box near an abandoned brick factory. Neil took all that with a grain of salt. He and the other investigators humored her, though, and looked where she said to look. Lucinda was correct, as it turned out, right down to the fact that the box was from an electronics store. Who was he to argue with facts, extraordinary as they might be? Neil found a new and instant respect for the wayward heiress who wore defiance like gang colors. Yet there was a sensitivity there, too, a vulnerability, somewhere beneath the brash and jaded facade. Patience brings payoff. The detective's credo has served Neil well where Lucinda Sloan is concerned. Early on, they crossed paths again and again in an effort to locate missing persons, evolving into colleagues, then friends, and now, perhaps, family is the most appropriate term for their relationship. Lucinda has become as close to Neil as his own daughters are, perhaps even more so, because he doesn't have to share her with Irma, and because he and Lucinda have been to hell and back together, more times than he cares to count. This is a brutal business. You can't help but grow hardened over time until you're almost immune to the victim's pain, to their loved one's pain, even to your own. You know it's there, the pain, but you can't let yourself feel it, because if you do, you'll never be able to get up the next morning and do what has to be done. This time, Neil is dangerously close to emotional involvement. He needs to take a step back, pull himself together, regain professional detachment. For Lucinda's sake. For Randy's. For Carla's. He remembers Randy Barricat's wife as a sweet, if needy, girl. Not woman. Girl. He remembers thinking, the first time he realized that something was simmering between Randy and Lucinda, which was pretty much the first time they ever came into contact with each other, that Carla Carnicki didn't stand a chance. Lucinda was no girl. She was woman enough for Randy, and he, unlike scores of others, was man enough for her. It wasn't just that Randy was a cop, but a damned good one. She'd dated and discarded plenty of cops before. It wasn't that he was as fearless as she, as extraordinarily good-looking as she, with just as sharp a sense of humor, or that he was as masculine as they come, with old-fashioned manners. It wasn't even that his family background had bred in him a steely core similar to her own, though for different reasons. His mother was an Irish Catholic, his father an Arab, coming from fiercely religious backgrounds into a marriage that was denounced by both families. His strength appealed to Lucinda, but as Neil saw it, the main reason Randall Barricat captured her heart was that he never once questioned her uncanny ability. Not skeptical or fascinated or even all that curious. He simply accepted her for who she was. Neil wasn't the only one who'd noticed the way Lucinda and Randy clicked. "Those two are written in the stars," Irma commented on the one and only occasion she saw the two of them in the same room. "I doubt that," Neil said, though he was secretly impressed his wife had picked up on it, too. "He's engaged to someone else." "Then I feel sorry for her."
"For Lucinda?" he'd asked, surprised, because feeling sorry for Lucinda Sloan was not customary by any means.
"No," Irma said. "For the someone else."
Randy had married her, though, in the end. Carla. And now she's dead. And her bloody ring was in Lucinda's possession. And Ava Neary, where does she fit into all this? Neil has been going over every detail, running the facts through his head like a computer processing forensic evidence, looking for a match. So far, he hasn't come up with a connection. In the kitchen, Neil sees the empty coffee pot sitting on the counter where Lucinda left it. They'll dust the whole area for prints. The whole place. Careful not to disturb anything, he moves through the apartment, past a couple of closed doors to the bedroom at the end of the hall. He stares at the unmade bed for a long time. This is where the album was found. Backtracking down the hall, he opens a door. Linen closet. Neatly stacked towels and sheets, everything in perfect order. He opens another door. The bathroom. Sweet Jesus, spills from Neil's lips, and he stares in disbelief. Chapter 7. Here, you should drink this. Lucinda slides the takeout coffee cup toward Randy. Where did it come from? He sips it. I brought it. It's probably cold by now. As if he notices or cares. Thank you. He sets down the cup and looks at her. I'm glad you came. When they first told me that you were in town, I was shocked for maybe the first few seconds. Then I thought, of course she is. Of course she's here. For some reason, it made perfect sense.
It did?
Because it still doesn't entirely make sense to her. He nods. I've no idea how you got here, but Lucinda, I need you.
He needs me.
And I need to be here for him.
Have your parents been here, or your sister? She asks him.
My parents were spending the winter in Florida. They're trying to get home. Julie was getting her kids off to school and finding someone to watch them later, and then she has to go pick up my parents at the airport.
I can go to the airport, or I can watch the kids, she offers, so that your sister can be with you.
No, that's sweet, but no. Thanks.
Does she still live in Cherry Hill? Because it's really no problem for me to...
Yes, she still lives there. But I need you here more than I need her. She's freaking out, you can imagine.
Yes, she can.
Randy's sister, a divorced single mom, is notoriously excitable. The drama queen, he always called her. Lucinda realizes that while there's so much she doesn't know about his life now, so much that's changed, there is still a lot that hasn't.
Well, what can I do then? She asks him.
Just be here with me, please. I don't want to be alone right now.
You won't be, she promises, patting his arm.
I'll stay as long as you need me. She has to tell him about the ring, but she's not sure where to start or whether it'll upset him. He looks as though he's about to say something, too. Is he going to bring up the lie? The phone rings.
Do you want me to get it?
No, I will.
Wearily, he picks it up.
It's one of the detectives working the case. Lucinda sips her own coffee as he talks, knowing the caffeine won't do a thing to assuage the ache of exhaustion gripping her body. When was the last time she got a decent night's sleep? Not even in Curacao, on that cloud of a fancy resort hotel bed, not with Jimmy sharing it. Uneasily, she allows herself to consider once again Neil's suspicion that Jimmy could have possibly been behind the scrapbook on her bed. If she were willing to believe that, she would also have to be willing to believe he could have killed Carla Barakat.
I have no idea who he really is.
This isn't the first time she's realized it, but the truth is more pronounced now that she's here with Randy.
Randy, she knows exactly who he is.
Knows him inside and out, even after all these years apart. Being with Randy feels natural in a way that nothing else in her life ever has. Being with other men, or with her family, or even alone, none of that feels right the way this does. Even here, even now, even being with him under the worst of circumstances, she belongs. It feels right. Which is wrong, especially here, especially now. But it is what it is. And you don't do guilt, remember?
They know, Randy realizes, going through the motions yet again with people who have dropped in to pay their respects. They all know, except Lucinda. He has to tell her. He meant to, sooner or later. Maybe this isn't the ideal time, but remarkably, she's here. Or maybe not so remarkably. I had a vision that something happened to Carla, so I drove out to check on her when I found out you were out of town, she explained earlier in her matter-of-fact way, sitting beside him at the kitchen table. A vision, of course. It just came to you out of the blue? She shook her head. Told him about the ring, Carla's ring, now in the possession of the police as evidence. She told him, too, about the strange pieces of paper found at both the murder scene and on Neil's kitchen table Monday night. Why didn't you tell me? Randy asked her, chilled by the ominous linkage of Lucinda to Carla. I couldn't. You couldn't have done anything about it from there anyway, and I could have been wrong. So you're the one who found her? No, I called the police and they did. He's glad. He's glad Lucinda wasn't the one who walked in on what must have been a bloodbath in the bathroom. Lambert told him, when he pressed for details he probably didn't really want to know, that Carla's jugular vein was severed, and she'd bled to death. He knows Lucinda has seen worse, much worse. But her being the one who found Carla would have complicated things even more than they are, or are about to be, anyway. Standing in the kitchen, surrounded by chattering acquaintances and enough saran-wrapped platters to stock a high school bake sale, Randy longs to pull her aside and tell her the truth. But there are too many people around, more pouring in every time the damned doorbell rings, people he didn't realize even knew Carla, and people he can't believe even care that she's dead. Whether they do or not, all appear genuinely shaken. If nothing else, an air of "there but for the grace of God" mourning permeates the house where Randy's wife bled to death. He doesn't want to see her. He has to, though. Has to officially identify her down at the morgue and sign the papers so that the death certificate can be issued. Lambert offered to have someone else do it, but Randy said that wouldn't be right. He can do this. It won't be easy, but he owes her this much. For now, though, it's enough to go numbly through the day, accepting condolences and bundt cakes, and to catch Lucinda's eye every once in a while, wishing he could be alone with her, so that he can tell her the truth at last. Sitting in the glider chair in the baby's room, nursing her little girl, Cam worries. Where is Lucinda? Cam could have sworn she'd said last week that she was only going to Curacao for the weekend, but maybe she extended the trip. She must have, because in the last 24 hours, Cam has left a couple of messages each on her home and cell phone voicemail, and Lucinda has yet to return the call. She can't have heard them yet, because Cam was increasingly adamant when she spoke into the phone that it was really important to connect. What if? No, Lucinda is fine. Of course she is. Cam stares out the window at the bare branched trees against an ice-blue winter sky, wishing she knew that for sure. But she can't allow her thoughts to take her to the dark place, can't allow herself to consider that something might have happened to her friend. Something that has something to do with Ava and the strange lipstick note she found in the mail. Mike, when she reached him yesterday morning, was concerned enough to tell her he'd cut the ski trip short and come home. No, Cam protested impulsively, though when she called, she supposed, she'd been hoping he'd offer to be on the next plane. But if Mike left the trip early, he'd miss out on something he looks forward to all year. Plus, she'd never hear the end of it from her father-in-law. Mike's father isn't one to withhold a grudge. He still blames Cam for, as he put it, nearly getting my granddaughter killed. As if only he has Tess's best interests at heart. As if Cam, or for that matter Tess, had been incredibly reckless. And then, of course, he was mortified by the press coverage which, as he puts it, drags all the dirty linen out of the closet for the world to see.
Dirty linen, meaning Cam's murdered sister.
Ignore him, Mike advised her. What else can you do? He's always been a jerk, and he always will be.
For Cam, who was always prepared to give Mike, Sr., the benefit of the doubt for her husband's sake, ignoring the man hasn't been very challenging. She hasn't even seen him lately, other than when he and Mike's mom came to see the baby in the hospital and a chaotic Christmas dinner in Connecticut. As far as she's concerned, if she doesn't see them until next Christmas, it'll be too soon.
Well, Mike's father, anyway.
His mother, she adores. Too bad they're usually a package deal. Cam has been inviting her mother-in-law down to stay for a week, but Mike's father doesn't believe in women traveling solo and claims he doesn't want to drive on winter roads to get her here.
No, but he doesn't mind driving up a winter mountain road in Utah to go skiing. Whatever.
Daddy's right, she tells baby Grace as she props her against her shoulder to burp her. Grandpa is a jerk. But don't tell anyone I told you, okay?
She's always careful never to say a bad word about her father-in-law in front of Tess, or about her own father, for that matter. Ike Neary has his faults, too, of course, brought on by an addictive personality and compounded by all the tragic loss he's suffered in his life. Pop isn't doing so well lately. He's been in and out of hospital since last fall, having been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. He has his good days, but there are more bad now. Often, when Cam goes to visit him, he thinks she's her mother.
Brenda, he'll say, where the hell have you been? I've been worried sick about you.
Once, when Cam came into the room just as he was waking up, he even thought she was Ava. Rather, Ava's ghost, apparently, meeting him at the pearly gates. You're alive, Pop. Cam kept telling him over and over. I'm not Ava. I'm Cam. He nodded, finally getting it.
You're Cam. Did you hear about Ava?
Hear what?
She's dead.
He wiped tears from his eyes.
Killed herself, poor thing.
No, Pop. She didn't kill herself. Somebody killed her. And now somebody might be trying to tell me what really happened. It's really no big deal, Mike, she told her husband on the phone, nonetheless, about the strange note in the mail.
It was a big enough deal to scare you. I'm coming home.
You do, and I'll be really pissed at you. He laughed. I'm serious, Mike.
That you'll be really pissed?
That you shouldn't come home. Listen, this is just another stupid prank thing, like all those hang-ups we got before we changed the phone number. And people who said they were Ava, or calling for Ava.
That's different. That was kids playing around.
I'm sure this is, too. She must have sounded convincing, because he agreed to stay in Utah through the end of the week as planned. Then he proceeded to call her every waking hour in the last 24.
Just checking in, everything okay?
Status quo, she tells him, every time.
The house is quiet today. Tess is at the mall with a girlfriend for a change. Her boyfriend doesn't have a school break in February, which spares Cam having to wedge some healthy distance between the lovebirds 24/7 this week. She stands, pulls the shade, and carries her drowsy baby across the plush white carpet. She lays her in the white cradle and winds the mobile hanging above it. A quartet of characters from the Hundred Acre Wood begin dancing slowly above Grace's head to tinkling Winnie the Pooh music. Take your nap, precious. Cam presses a kiss against her downy hair. Mama will be back to check on you, but right now I have to check on someone else. She closes the door behind the baby and goes into the master bedroom. When Mike moved out last year, she avoided spending time here. She hated seeing the half-empty closet and barren dresser top, hated having the king-sized bed all to herself. Now that it's a happy, cozy room again, she's glad to retreat here with a book or her journal when the baby naps. She's even been writing again lately. Poetry and short stories. Not that any of it's very good,
or that she's willing to show anyone, not even Mike, who has been encouraging her to try publishing something. Maybe someday. She picks up the phone on the bedside table and dials Lucinda's home number. Voicemail again. Lucinda, it's Cam. Now I don't just need to talk to you. I'm worried about you. Please call and let me know you're okay as soon as you get this.
Oh, she's perfectly okay, he assures Camden Hastings's disembodied voice.
She will be for quite some time, but I can't guarantee anything past, oh, let's say, June.
He laughs aloud, hard. It always feels good to laugh. It's a release.
Sometimes in prison, well after lights out, some random thought would amuse him, and he'd let loose with a rip-roaring belly laugh that would echo down the C-block in the dead of night. The others would stir and start banging on the walls and barred windows of their cells, hollering at him to shut up. And then the guards would show up to investigate, shining lights in his face, which he found even funnier.
You know, I've always loved the spotlight, he'd say, and writhe and clutch his gut as howls exploded from him, laughing until his ribs ached and there was a knot of pain at the back of his throat. What the hell is so funny? They'd demand, almost suspiciously, just as his teachers had when he was a kid. As if he were hiding something. As if humor were some kind of threat. He never told anyone why he was laughing, because most of the time, he really didn't know. And it really didn't matter. He only knew that it felt good. It always felt good to let it all out, to purge until he was spent. Laughter. And sometimes, rage.
To hear this message again, press 1, a mechanical voice advises him. To save it, press 2. To erase it, press 3.
He wipes tears of mirth from his eyes and presses 1, just for the fun of it. Lucinda, it's Cam. Now I don't just need to talk to you. I'm worried about you. Please call and let me know you're okay as soon as you get this. He relishes the urgency in her voice, glad to have this opportunity. Getting into her PIN-protected voicemail, email, and computer files was tricky, but not impossible for someone like him, schooled in the old C-block. He'd emerged with plenty of connections in the outside world, along with fresh knowledge and training in areas that would come in handy in his business, courtesy of the state prison reforms. In Lucinda Sloane's case, all it took was a keyboard sniffer installed on her laptop while she was out one day. The software is readily available for purchase, and cash is not hard to come by when one has no qualms about where and how one obtains it. He learned Lucinda's voicemail access code the old-fashioned way, by observing her from the rooftop next door with a pair of high-powered binoculars. People entering PINs in the so-called privacy of their own homes don't attempt to shield the movements of their fingers from prying eyes the way they do at ATMs. All he'd had to do was watch for her to come home each night, knowing that the first thing she'd do was check her voicemail. It took a few weeks for her to stand with the phone at exactly the right angle, in exactly the right spot, in front of one of the apartment's many windows. But he had all the time and patience in the world. The whole thing, really, is a waiting game. How many nights had he reminded himself of that, watching from his rooftop perch as she slept, bathed in the glow of the bedside lamp? Never before had he had such an opportunity, not with the others. No one else slept all night with the light on. Had he not known all along of Lucinda Sloane's weakness, her fear of the dark, he might have interpreted that bedside lamp as a beacon. He might have been tempted, the night he slipped into her apartment through a window to borrow her keys and make a duplicate set, to let her blood ooze across those nice white sheets, right then and there. But he knows her secret. And of course, he possesses a level of self-control and intelligence unmatched in any other human being he's ever known. Killing her right then and there wouldn't be nearly as satisfying as what he has planned. It's so nice to have something to look forward to, really. And so he slipped away with her keys, made himself a set, and returned them well before dawn. Grinning, he reaches into his pocket, unfolding a well-worn newspaper clipping. "Sexy soothsayer superhero," screams the kitschy tabloid headline. And there she is, smiling out at him in sepia tones, aside from the little adjustment he couldn't help making. Photoshop would have been more effective, but this will do. "See you soon, Lucinda," he tells her, admiring the delicate arch of her brow and the sassy gleam in her eye, and, above all, the lips he carefully stained red with a whittled nub of lipstick. It refused to stay defined, but instead bled across the newsprint, giving her a garish clown's mouth. No matter. Soon enough, he'll have another chance with the real thing. Whistling, he tucks the clipping back into his pocket and picks up his suitcase. He has a flight to catch. All morning and late into the afternoon, as people come and go, Lucinda remains at Randy's side. "I need you," he said simply when, earlier, the doorbell started ringing incessantly, and strangers, to her anyway, started filling the house, and she offered to give him some space. "Please don't leave me." So she's still here, trying to stay helpful yet out of the way as the investigators do their thing and friends and neighbors stop by to offer condolences. They stand in little knots in the kitchen and speak in hushed voices, and when they leave, they always say, "If you need anything, Randy, just call." He thanks them, and somehow he keeps his composure through it all, even when they don't. It's obvious he's built a life here on the island, that he and Carla were, a part of the community. Lucinda brews endless pots of coffee and keeps a list of who brought what. Randy might want it later, so that he'll know whom to thank. She figures the names and faces must be a blur for him now. A few of the visitors are obviously closer to him than others, some of whom strike Lucinda as ghoulish curiosity seekers, yet even they seem truly shaken by his loss. As the day wears on, though, Lucinda notices that even among the inner circle, there's an undercurrent of something other than just sympathy. Resentment? Nosiness? Whatever it is, it seems to have something to do with her presence. Randy introduces her over and over as an old friend, yet she senses closer scrutiny than a platonic relationship merits, particularly from the women, a few who are middle-aged locals and a couple who are considerably younger and must be friends of Carla's. It's likely they recognize her from last summer's media blitz, but as Lucinda finds herself being sized up repeatedly, something tells her there's more to their interest than that. Is it possible that her secret past with Randy is common knowledge here on the island? Or is it already public knowledge that she's the one who called the police before they found Carla's body? Neil is finally about to head back here with the evidence, after spending a few hours overseeing the investigation at Lucinda's apartment.
"I want you to be careful there, Sin," Neil warned from his cell phone when she reached him a little while ago.
"Neil, it's broad daylight, and I'm surrounded by people. Oh, and P.S., a lot of them are cops. What can possibly happen to me?"
"Just be careful."
"Why? Did something else happen?" There was a telltale pause.
"I'm on my way. I'll talk to you when I get there."
"Did you remember to get my BlackBerry charger?"
"Got it," he said, and hung up before she could ask him anything else.
Standing in Lucinda's living room, Neil gazes out the window at the squad cars parked on the street below, wondering if Carla Barakat's killer can see them too. Is he lurking somewhere nearby, keeping an eye on Lucinda's place, waiting to strike again? Detective Lenny Ruzhitska, Roz, as he's known around the station, finishes yet another cell phone conversation, hangs up, and walks back over to Neil.
"Sorry about all the interruptions. Crazy day," What's going on?
Neil asks, not really caring. They think they might have an ID on that John Doe from this morning.
That's good.
Neil had heard about the case earlier. An older male had been found over on South 18th Street, shot once through the head, apparent robbery victim. His wallet was, of course, missing.
Yeah, we've got a worried wife, Mary Lou Armano, who called to report her husband missing. His name's Joe. He works as a bartender at a club over by Rittenhouse Square. Never came home last night. His description fits Doe. Gray hair, brown eyes, medium build, bit of a gut.
It fits a lot of men, including Roz himself, Neil can't help thinking.
Good, he says again. About this.
He sweeps a hand toward Lucinda's bathroom down the hall, where a couple of officers are dusting for prints.
I'll have them email the photos right out to you, and you can access them when you get out to the island. What about?
I'll go get it. Hang on. He steps away to talk to one of the investigators in the next room. Neil thinks about Frank Santiago, who's leading the case in Beach Haven. He's a good investigator, one of the best cops to come out of Neil's class at the police academy all those years ago. Not exactly a friend, though. Their personalities didn't mesh. Frank was arrogant, Neil thought. Swagger didn't appeal to him. One stormy January night after class, Frank's car wouldn't start. Neil tried to give him a jump, but that didn't work. He wound up driving Frank all the way home to Reading, over an hour in the opposite direction, but it took two because of the weather, and three back.
I owe you one, Frank told Neil the next day. I won't forget it. Don't worry. I won't let you.
He didn't. Frank left Philadelphia soon after, landing in Atlantic City homicide. Neil kept track of him. After years in the gritty trenches, Frank is winding down his career in Beach Haven. Neil finally called in the favor a few years ago.
Are we even? Frank asked when the deal was done. Hell no. I'd say you owe me an even bigger favor now.
How's that?
You just got yourself one hell of a good cop.
Randy Barricat. Neil hated to lose him, but he knew it was best that he move on. Knew he'd better do it in a place that was far removed from Philadelphia. And Lucinda.
Here you go.
Roz is back. He hands over the manila envelope containing a photocopy of the sheet of paper found on Neil's kitchen table. They're keeping the original here, of course, as evidence.
Thanks, Roz. Keep me posted, will ya?
You bet. Drive safe.
Neil nods and heads out the door. The street lights are flicking on when Lucinda sees the retired couple from down the street to the door, followed closely by a trio of guys from Randy's summer softball league, then the white-colored priest from the local church. Finally shutting the door behind her, she realizes they've reached a welcome lull. The house is quiet at last. Probably not for long, though. In the kitchen, she rinses the last acrid bit of coffee from the bottom of the carafe and is refilling it, thinking again about Carla's ring when Randy comes up beside her.
How are you holding up?
You're asking me?
You look exhausted.
I'm fine. How are you?
Not fine.
I know. She turns off the tap. Do you want to go lie down or something? If anyone shows up, I'll tell them.
No, just sit down. I want to talk to you.
Heart pounding, she sits. So does he. Something is up. Paranoia seeps in. Could he possibly be questioning her involvement in what happened here yesterday? Or is he going to acknowledge that he lied about speaking to Carla after she'd been killed? Unwilling to let him see her concern, Lucinda rests her chin in her hand and waits. Not for long, though.
There's something you should know.
She nods. Randy curses as the doorbell rings yet again. Do you want me to get that? She asks, starting to push her chair back.
No,
he grasps her wrist. Damn it, I want to tell you this.
Okay, tell me.
Carla and I. The doorbell again. Detective Lambert sticks his head in.
Want me to get it?
I guess you have to, Randy says tersely, eyes focused on Lucinda.
See if you can get rid of whoever it is, Dan.
Lambert nods, disappears. Fixated on Randy's face, Lucinda coaxes softly.
Go ahead.
I'm listening.
Carla and I, we've been separated for a while. I moved out last September.
Chapter 8. Located on almost 400 acres of picturesque woodland at the United States Marine Corps Base, 40 miles southwest of Washington, D.C., the FBI Academy complex looks for all the world like a secluded college campus. As Vic strides through the glass corridors connecting the buildings, he takes it as a positive sign that nothing has changed during his nearly 18-month absence. It's almost as if he never left, aside from the fact that he can no longer come and go with a flash of official ID. For a good portion of Vic's career, the Behavioral Science Unit was located in the bowels of the Academy, but they've since moved up in the world. By the time he left, Vic had a relatively spacious window office. He passes its closed door on the way to his destination and feels only a mild pang of regret-tinged nostalgia. He has a feeling it would probably be much more pronounced were he still sitting around watching television day in and day out. But writing the book has captivated him in a way his FBI work once did. Apparently, the media attention has captivated the unsub as well. A secretary takes his coat, then ushers him into the meeting he scheduled yesterday morning, immediately after opening the mail.
Good to see you again, Vic.
Supervisory Special Agent Annabelle Wyatt stands and shakes his hand across her file-stacked desk. Funny. All those years he worked with her, Vic never noticed how much Annabelle reminds him of a much thinner Oprah, with the same dark beauty, the same authoritative demeanor. That's because you'd never seen an episode of Oprah when you were working here. You had other things to do. As he does now.
I hear you're keeping busy with your book,
Annabelle tells him, and he can't tell by her tone whether she approves or disapproves of the project. He does know that it's either one or the other, though. If he learned anything about Annabelle Wyatt when they were colleagues, it's that she has a strong opinion about everything, though she'll usually keep it to herself.
I was told you had something to show me, Vic. Highly sensitive evidence.
Yes. He reaches into the pocket of his suit coat and removes the envelope, now encased in a plastic bag. She immediately puts on a pair of gloves, opens the envelope, removes the paper, and unfolds it.
The Night Watchman, Annabelle says without hesitation. Where did you get this?
Yesterday's mail.
Who have you told?
My wife and you.
Thank you, Vic. We'll get right on it.
Either he just committed a murder, or he's about to. We need to start cross-referencing every homicide case we can find across the country that has a remotely similar M.O. to the Night Watchman cases we have on file. Check all the murders that happened when the moon was full. Annabelle gives him a long, hard look.
We may do that, Vic.
Her emphasis on the first word is unmistakable, as it is on the next.
You're retired now, remember? Go home and enjoy it.
He had anticipated her response, of course. Once you're gone, you're gone. It isn't unheard of for the FBI to reach out to a retired agent to assist on a cold case, but that would be a matter of, don't call us, we'll call you. Still, it stings, just a little.
I've been up to my eyeballs in research on this guy for months now, he reminds Annabelle. If you need me to... We'll call.
Thanks, Vic. This isn't the first time Lucinda has been inside this small, windowless room in the Long Beach Township Police Headquarters. 6 months later, it all comes rushing back to her. Tess Hastings had just gone missing, and Lucinda was here to tell the authorities about a vision she'd had. A vision she was certain involved Tess being thrown from a Manhattan rooftop. Of course, it turned out to have been Ava, the look-alike aunt who had died decades before Tess was born. Tess was far from safe that night as Lucinda and Randy and the other detectives sat strategizing in this room, but she survived. Tonight, as on that August night, the mood is somber. Yet there is no sense of urgency as they all take their seats around the big table. Like last time, files and papers and coffee cups litter the room. Unlike last time, Neil Bullard is present, waiting for them there when they arrive. He drove straight here when he got into town, then called Randy's house and asked that the two of them meet him at headquarters. Lucinda welcomed the interruption, still reeling from Randy's announcement that his marriage had been over for months now. Right after Randy dropped the bombshell, Lambert escorted Randy's sister Julie into the kitchen. She was sobbing, and after a few minutes, Lucinda could tell that her emotions were setting Randy's even more on edge. He left the room, and Lucinda did her best to calm Julie, who stayed for a good hour, pretty much crying inconsolably the whole time. By the time his sister left to go pick up their parents at the airport in Newark, the moment between Randy and Lucinda had passed. Just as well. She isn't sure how to feel about what Randy told her. Even if she'd known long before now, she would hardly have been jumping for joy. The end of a marriage is no cause for celebration, regardless of the implications it might have had given Lucinda's feelings for Randy. Now, with Carla's death, she can't relate to it on a personal level at all. No wonder the house felt so barren. No wonder she sensed an awkwardness when all those people offered Randy their condolences. No wonder they were intrigued by Lucinda's presence. Knowing he had left Carla, they must have been suspicious about the nature of his relationship with Lucinda. They probably thought her being there was inappropriate. Who knows? Small-town gossip travels fast. Maybe the locals somehow even knew that she and Randy were once more than friends. But that's all we are now. The lead investigator, Frank Santiago, made it clear that she and Neil are in this meeting because they're directly involved in the case. But he emphasized that they won't be privy to the ongoing investigation. Not on this end, anyway. "How are you holding up?" someone asks Randy as they gather around the table. "I'm okay. Better now that the shock is wearing off." They all nod, and Lucinda wonders what they're thinking. Does the fact that Randy and Carla were separated make the loss any easier for him to bear? Maybe. Already, he wasn't planning on spending the rest of his life with Carla, so the impact on his day-to-day life will be lessened. Even so, her death is no less tragic within its own context. Her life was brutally taken.
"I want you to know we're going to put every resource we have into solving this crime."
Santiago, a tall, lean man with an aquiline nose and sharp-edged black goatee, leans forward, pressing his palms authoritatively on the table.
"We're going to get the son of a bitch who did this, Randy. I promise you."
The other law officers nod in mute agreement as Santiago breaks off to cough, wheezing with the effort.
"Sorry," he says. "I've had pneumonia this winter."
He pulls a handkerchief from his pocket to cover his mouth, and his eyes collide with Lucinda's. Seized by the sudden impression that he isn't well, and that it's more complicated than pneumonia, she feels a flash of empathy for the man. Cancer, she realizes. Poor Frank. Does he even know? Looking away from her, he makes brief introductions of those seated around the table. When he reaches Lucinda, he says,
"I'm sure some of you remember Lucinda Sloan, the psychic investigator who worked with our team last summer on the Pearson case."
"So you're going to be working on this case too?" one of the young uniforms asks.
"If I'm needed."
Lucinda's voice is thin, starting to rasp a little. That always happens to her when she's tired. If she's not careful, it'll go into full-blown laryngitis. She can feel Santiago's black-eyed gaze on her
and doesn't dare meet it. Last summer, when he was on the periphery of the Pearson and Hastings cases, she always sensed a disapproving vibe coming her way. It didn't really bother her then. She's used to territorial, skeptical, even chauvinistic investigators. She tries not to let it bother her now, either. Santiago, after another brief coughing bout, begins by telling them all what Lucinda had already guessed. The medical examiner had estimated that Carla had been dead for several days when she was found.
Lambert said you're going to ID her, Randy.
Yes. Santiago peers at him with concern.
Do you want to have someone else do it?
No. Randy swallows hard. I can do it.
Okay. Lambert, drive him over to the morgue after this.
Santiago lays two sheets of paper side by side for everyone to see.
One of these was found by Ms. Sloan and Detective Bullard on Detective Bullard's kitchen table Monday night. The other was bagged with one of the newspapers lying at the foot of the driveway, Randy. I realize the neighborhood is quiet at this time of year, but I'm still surprised that no one at least checked to make sure Carla was okay with all those papers piling up.
But Carla never picked up the paper, Randy responds. I kept meaning to stop the subscription, since I was the one who paid for it, and I was the only one who ever read it. She lets them pile up out there for days. She walks right by them to get into her car. If I didn't stop by and get them, she'd dump them when she put out the cans on trash day. Wheezing a little, Santiago rubs his beard.
Do these numbers mean anything to you?
Randy shakes his head.
Anyone else?
Silence. Santiago looks pointedly at Neil, who clears his throat and turns to Lucinda. She feels her body instinctively clench, going into defensive mode.
I wanted to show you this first, privately, Neil says, but I didn't get the chance.
Show me what? Her heart is pounding. He slides a blown-up photograph toward her. Everyone leans in to look. The picture was snapped, looking into a mirror. Neil's torso is visible in one corner, topped by a circle of flashbulb glare. The mirror is gilt-framed. Scrawled on the glass, in what looks like blood, are garish numerals. 87.7. 41.9.
This, Neil announces to the room as renewed dread screeches through her mind, is Lucinda's bathroom mirror. I found it earlier when I stopped by her apartment back in Philadelphia.
Is that blood? One of the officers asks.
Red lipstick.
Lucinda looks up just in time to see a look pass between Lambert and Van Aken, seated directly across from her. Shifting her gaze to Santiago, she notes that he's shaking his head a little at Lambert and Van Aken, as if to warn them not to say anything.
Anything like what?
She checks Randy's reaction. He glances from the photo to Lucinda herself, wearing an expectant expression. It wasn't there when I left yesterday morning, she manages to say, needlessly. Someone must have gotten in again while I was gone.
For what it's worth, Sin, Neil says, there was no indication that someone broke in. Who's had access to your keys?
Besides you, you mean? She quips humorlessly, knowing what Neil's thinking. It could have been anyone, over time, because she had never changed the locks. A past tenant, a friend of a past tenant, an acquaintance of the landlord, one of the electricians or plumbers who came and went during the upgrades. It could have been Jimmy, too. He could have slipped her keys out of her bag and made a copy. He's not the only one, but he certainly had ample opportunity. Neil and the others wait for a response. She doesn't dare look at Randy, but she can feel his eyes fixed on her. Can feel his concern. My friend Bradley has the keys. She exhales through puffed cheeks. I gave him the spare set when he helped me move in, because he was coming and going without me there. But there's no way he...
Who?
Interrupts Sergeant Van Aken, still not exactly Lucinda's best bud. Is your friend Bradley? Bradley Carmichael.
Bradley Carmichael IV, but who's counting?
He's a friend from New York. I met him at his cousin's wedding last year, and we got to be good friends.
Really good friends. Fast friends, the way it was with Cam. Two strangers thrown together under unique circumstances.
Look, she tells Neil, tells all of them, feeling their dubious stares. I trust Bradley.
You haven't known him for very long, Neil points out.
I've known him long enough to know he would never hurt me. Or anyone else. Neil nods, though his eyes ask her if she's absolutely sure about that, and so does a little voice in the back of her head.
What should I wear?
Jamie Dobiak asks her friend Nancy above the Coldplay song blasting from the iPod plugged into the dock on her clock radio. She holds up two hangers from her closet.
The red or the black?
Sprawled on Jamie's blue bedspread, Nancy doesn't bother to look up from the latest issue of Cosmopolitan she'd found on the nightstand. Red, you could use a little color in your life.
I have plenty of color in my life.
Jamie gestures around her newly painted bedroom. Blue walls, blue curtains, blue bedspread. Even blue tissues in the box beside the bed.
And look what I bought yesterday.
She holds up a bright yellow silk Hermes scarf. With the sale price and her employee discount at Bloomingdale's, it was a steal.
Do you like it?
I love it, Nancy tells her. Are you going to wear it?
Not with this.
She holds it against the black dress.
I'd look like a bumblebee.
Don't wear that. You wear too much black.
But black is slimming.
True. Heaven knows Jamie could stand to lose 10 pounds, although the weight charts always say she's in a healthy range for her height. Too much beer, not enough exercise. But between a full-time job as a secretary and a part-time one at Bloomie's on Michigan Avenue, the only way to afford her wardrobe and the rent on this great apartment off West Division Street in walking distance to all her favorite clubs, who has time for the gym? Granted, she might if she cut out the nightly partying. But not yet a year out of college and on her own for the first time in Chicago, Jamie Dobiak has no intention of taming her social life just yet. She tosses the yellow scarf over the bedpost. Standing in front of the full-length mirror, she holds one dress up to her chin, and then the other, swaying in time to the music.
I love this song.
She turns up the volume.
What? I said I love this song.
The neighbors are going to call the cops. Nancy glances up at last.
No, the walls are really thick. Like, soundproof.
What?
Soundproof walls.
That's what the landlord told her when she moved in last summer. That, along with a prime location near all Jamie's favorite hangouts on West Division and Rush Streets, was a big selling point. Not because she's a light sleeper or concerned about the neighbors' parties. Rather, because she's worried that the neighbors are light sleepers and might complain about her frequent after-hours parties. No one ever has, because they don't hear a thing. The song ends. Jamie turns down the volume and compares the two hangers again.
I need a verdict, Nance.
Wear the red. You look good in red with your coloring. Blonde hair and blue eyes go with everything in her closet, as far as Jamie's concerned.
Whatever.
She'll wear the red. She even has the lipstick to match, having stopped by the makeup counter at Bloomie's before Valentine's Day to pick up a daring new shade. It's called Blood Red. Her Valentine's Day date said it looked good on her. She'll wear it again, tonight. They don't call this the Windy City for nothing. He shivers and pulls the collar of his black overcoat higher around his neck as he walks along State Street, rolling his dark blue Samsonite bag along behind him. No one gives him a second glance. He's one in a cast of thousands, business people in town for meetings and seminars and whatever the hell it is that business people do. He had the cab driver from O'Hare drop him at a different hotel, the enormous upscale Renaissance over on Wacker,
just in case.
Here for the conference? The cabbie, a talkative older guy with a flat Midwestern accent, asked.
That's right, he replied, and wondered what kind of conference it was.
He hoped the cabbie wouldn't ask any specific questions, because then he wouldn't be able to answer them, and he'd have to get rid of the guy. And really, he's too busy for that right now. Luckily for him, for both of them, really, the cabbie didn't bother to ask, just collected his fare and tip with a, "Hey, thanks for all the ones. I can use 'em. I've been breaking 20s all day. A lot of short trips, being it so cold out."
No problem.
He tipped the doorman who came over to open the cab door with yet another dollar bill from the tremendous wad in his pocket.
Thank you, sir.
Sir. He grinned.
No problem.
He made his way through the sea of professional types in the busy lobby, bought some mints and a newspaper at the lobby shop, visited the men's room. When a good 15 minutes had passed, he left, crossing Wacker and heading across the river. Always cover your tracks.
Right this way, Randy.
He nods, and with his friend Dan at his side, follows the medical examiner's assistant, Sherry is her name, through a set of doors. A pert little blonde, Sherry is wearing a snug white-ribbed turtleneck, tucked into a snug black tweed skirt, with heels that tap, tap, tap along the tile floors. They know each other fairly well, professionally, of course. He's escorted a number of people into the small viewing room at the morgue, distraught families of car wreck victims, mostly. How many times has he half-walked, half-carried a hysterical mother back through these doors with her screeching, "My baby!" Now it's his turn to be escorted to that awful room.
"Do you want me to come in with you?" Lambert asks, laying a hand on Randy's shoulder when they reach the door.
"No, it's okay." He takes a deep breath. "Let's just do this." Sherry opens the door with a jangling of her charm bracelet. Her nails, Randy notices, are long and polished bright red, with little gold hearts painted on the tip of each one. The gaudy, cheerful manicure seems wrong here. Maybe it's not. Who knows? Maybe it's better, in this place where death hangs in the halls like a killing frost, to have a reminder that somewhere out there, life goes on. Somewhere out there, pretty girls polish their nails, wear charm bracelets, celebrate Valentine's Day, stuff like that. Then Randy is in the room with his dead wife. She's lying there on a steel table with her eyes closed, looking just like all the other corpses he's seen. Skin an unearthly gray shade, almost a dark blue around her lips, features concave, hair pulled back from her face. The smell of death assaults his nostrils, but it isn't overpowering. They've cleaned her up the best they can. When he leaves, he knows, the process will begin. They'll undress her and cut her up for the autopsy, officially determine what killed her when the evidence is right there, beneath an enormous gauze bandage shielding her neck.
"Randy?" Sherry asks softly.
"It's her. It's Carla."
Sherry nods. After a moment, she hands him a clipboard. He signs the papers. Just a formality.
"Do you want a minute with her?"
He nods. Sherry steps somberly into the hall. He can hear her voice, low, and then Dan's. Hot tears pool in his eyes, then spill over. He looks at Carla, forces himself to really look. One last time.
"I'm sorry, baby,"
he whispers raggedly and touches her cold blue hand. She isn't wearing her wedding band. She wouldn't be. She took it off in September. He did the same with his. Of course, she isn't wearing her mother's sterling signet ring either. She wore it every day on the ring finger of her right hand because it's too big for her pinky. Every night that Randy lived with her, when she got ready for bed, she would take off her earrings and her watch and whatever other jewelry she had been wearing during the day, and she would put it in a little tray on her dresser. But she never removed the signet ring, the wedding band, either. Not until September. Her murderer stole the signet ring and left it for Lucinda to find. Did he steal her other jewelry as well? Randy looks to her earlobes, mottled and dark. The piercings are bare. Oh, she's wearing pajamas. He's seen them before. Blue top with 3/4-length sleeves and blue and green striped pants. That's why her jewelry is off. She had already gotten ready for bed when she died. That doesn't necessarily mean that it was late. Sometimes Carla got ready for bed before the sun even went down and ate dinner in her pajamas. He'll have to look back at the house, at the little tray on the dresser for her earrings and whatever else she'd had on the day she died. Make sure nothing else is missing. Randy hears a stirring in the hall and looks up. Both Sherry and Dan are looking in at him. You okay? Dan asks. Of course not. He's here with his dead wife. I'm okay. He sighs and reaches out to touch her hand one last time. Her extremities are purplish blue. Her hand feels weirdly thick and cold and hard. I'm sorry, Carla, he whispers, bending to press a kiss against her hand. That's when he sees the watch around her wrist. Chapter 9. Lucinda left her car back at Randy's house when they headed over to the police station earlier.
Just leave it there and ride with me, Neil tells her now as he stands, buttoning his coat, just inside the doors at police headquarters.
No, I want my car, she tries to fight a yawn.
Look at you. How are you going to drive for 2 hours after days without sleep?
I'll manage.
At least let me drive you over there to get it, then, and we can follow each other back. We're going to the same place.
Yes, to Neil's place. She's already agreed to stay in the Bullards' guest room for a few days, and not with much reluctance. Returning to her own apartment is, of course, out of the question for the time being. 87.7, 41.9. What do those numbers mean? She's been running them through her head ever since Neil showed the photograph, to no avail. Santiago said they've run them through search engines and come up with countless references to, among other things, weight, weather, and air temperature. Nothing makes sense in terms of what's going on here. They're going to analyze them, possibly even call in a numerologist. The meeting lasted almost 2 hours, with countless interruptions. That was the way it always went in an active investigation. Unfortunately, they had no new information or potential leads by the time they left. Santiago asked the homicide investigators to assemble again later. Of course, to go over all the details that couldn't be revealed to Lucinda and Neil, or even to Randy, as a victim of this crime, rather than an investigator. Lucinda half expected Neil to protest when they were dismissed, but he was anxious to get on the road. Irma had called him during the meeting, worried because the forecast along the shore calls for sleet, with snow inland. Meteorology and her own exhaustion be damned. Lucinda is in no hurry to leave. Not without making sure Randy's okay after having gone to the morgue to identify Carla's body.
I told Randy I was going to wait here for him to come back. Go ahead, Neil. I promise I'll be fine.
Call my cell when you get on the road.
I will.
And don't wait too long.
I won't.
10 minutes after Neil departs, Randy is back from the morgue, looking shaken.
How are you? Are you okay?
Not really.
He accepts the cup full of Poland Spring water she pours him from the cooler.
How can she leave him like this?
They ride back over to the house in Officer Lambert's sedan. Randy sits in the front seat, drawn and quiet. Lucinda in the back, wishing she could comfort him somehow.
We're going to find out who did it, Randy,
Lambert tells him. You know Santiago will be on this thing like a pit bull until he's got someone in custody.
I know.
Is he sick? Lucinda asks them, remembering what she sensed earlier in the conference room. Santiago, I mean.
He's had pneumonia, Dan says.
No, something more serious than that. I felt it. I saw it. Realizing Frank might not want anyone to know, or might not even know himself, she shakes her head. Never mind, I could be wrong. But I'm not.
Randy's phone rings. It's his sister Julie calling to say that their parents' flight had been delayed because of the weather in Newark. Their plane is still sitting at the gate in Florida.
Forget about driving them all the way out here tonight when they get in, Julie, he says. If they even get in.
Sitting in the back seat, Lucinda can hear Julie protesting into his ear.
No, just tell them I'll see them first thing tomorrow, he says. It's okay, I'm okay.
Julie is audibly crying on the other end of the telephone line and talking. A lot. Randy listens, tries to interrupt, listens some more.
Yeah, he manages to say at last. I'm sure I'll be fine tonight. I'm exhausted. I just want to get some rest.
Lucinda can relate to that. Her body feels numb with the lack of sleep, and she's starting to feel as though her brain is headed in the same direction.
Randy hangs up just as the squad car arrives in front of the Barraquette's house, darkened for the night, other than the doorstep light and a single lamp Randy left burning in the living room. Lucinda and Randy climb out. The wind is blowing incessantly, and a fine mist is already in the air, not yet sleet, but it can't be far off.
Do you want to come back to my cottage with me and have a cup of coffee before you head back? Randy asks as they stand beside her car, both with their own keys in hand.
Where is it?
Just a couple of blocks away. She hesitates.
Okay, sure.
Going to his apartment is probably a bad idea for more reasons than she cares to think about, but she can tell he doesn't want to be alone yet. Anyway, she could use a cup of coffee for the road. It's a long drive.
Good. I just want to check the house one last time, and then you can follow me over.
Lucinda climbs into her car to wait, starts the engine, and turns the heat on full blast, wishing the frigid interior would warm up. She's cold, and she's tired, and she's unnerved by the dark and by the unbelievable sequence of events that led her to this moment.
Cam,
with all that's gone on, Lucinda forgot to call her.
I can't let it go. I've got to call her as soon as I get over to Randy's.
As she hugs herself and stares out the windshield, a figure appears on the sidewalk, eerily illuminated by the misty glow from the headlights. It's a man, or it could be a larger woman, wearing a parka and walking a dog. The person's hood is pulled up and zipped tight around the face, obviously one of the neighbors. For all Lucinda knows, she poured coffee for this person at Randy's this afternoon. Yet she can't see enough of the face to rule out a stranger, and if the person recognizes her, he or she is not letting on. Lucinda can feel him, her, staring in this direction with more than casual interest. Is it concerned neighborhood watch-type interest in light of the fact that a woman was murdered a stone's throw away? Or is it nosy, gossipy interest, stemming from the fact that the dead woman's estranged husband might be seeing another woman? The figure passes slowly, more slowly than is necessary as the dog strains at the leash. Randy comes out and gets into his car without glancing toward the street, and the dog walker watches him, too. Randy pulls up alongside Lucinda and gestures for her to roll down her window.
Follow me, he calls above the wind. It's only a few blocks away, off Bay Avenue.
Certain his voice carried along the sidewalk, she wonders if she should tell him she's changed her mind and is heading back.
Just because some busybody is snooping around?
Please, who cares what people think?
Randy is her friend.
a friend in need.
I'll follow you, she agrees, and promptly shifts into drive.
He's reached the towering Westin on North Dearborn. Like the Renaissance, it's a sleek, upscale hotel, its lobby also filled with businessmen in overcoats with rolling luggage. Candles flicker pleasantly.
Checking in, sir?
He looks around to see a uniformed bellman.
Yes.
Need a hand with your bag?
No, thanks.
No way is he taking any chances with letting it out of his sight. But he hands the bellman a dollar anyway. The kid looks a bit mystified, but pockets it and walks away. He likes being called sir, he decides, as he heads for the reception desk. It's about time he earned some of the respect he deserves. He waits his turn to check in, pretending to check email on his BlackBerry, like everyone else. Of course, it's just for show. If you're playing a role, you must, of course, have the right wardrobe and the right props. You want to look like a construction worker? You need jeans, steel-toed boots, one of those insulated lunch bags. Soccer dad? You get your hands on a great camera, khakis, and a polo shirt. And so it goes. He stole the BlackBerry just a little while ago at O'Hare, lifting it boldly right out of the pocket holster of a businessman waiting to board a plane in the overcrowded terminal. With luck, the person, normalwe@AOL.com, didn't realize it was missing until he was